You're listening to SBS News.
There is no policy of starvation in Gaza.
That's real starvation stuff. I see it. You can't fake that.
This is the moment to act.
Today's deal creates certainty in uncertain times.
Russia keeps launching such attacks even when the whole world is calling on it to stop.
It's that time of the week again. I'm joined this week by our chief international correspondent, Ben Lewis from London, for this week's episode of World News Weekly. Hello, Ben.
Hi, Kat.
Back from Scotland. So tell me, did you play a round of golf with Trump?
I didn't, partly because I just got shot by the Secret Service, and partly because, believe this, it is $1,000 Australian to play one round at Donald Trump's new golf course. So there was a lot of golf. But I can assure you there was some diplomacy on the side. We'll unpack all the latest from the US president's trip to Aberdeen, golf swings and all.
Plus, the latest countries to come out in support of Palestinian statehood.
And a ceasefire agreement for two Southeast Asian neighbours on the brink of war this week. Claudia Farhart will join us for the latest developments on the cross-border conflict from Bangkok.
I can confirm the UK will recognise the state of Palestine by the United Nations General Assembly in September, unless the Israeli government takes substantive steps to end the appalling situation in Gaza.
This intention is predicated on the Palestinian Authority's commitment to much-needed reforms, including commitments by the Palestinian Authority's President Abbas to fundamentally reform its governance.
And this is why the solution of the two states and the recognition of the state of Palestine, the only way to build peace and stability for all.
Last week, we spoke about international condemnation of Israel in response to harrowing images we continue to see coming out of Gaza of starving civilians. Health authorities in Gaza now say 159 people have died from starvation. 89 of those are children, and most have occurred in the past few weeks alone. This, as Israel announced on the weekend, a 10-hour pause in fighting daily to allow new aid corridors and have allowed countries to airdrop supplies into the enclave amid criticism, though, that it's still not enough to feed the starving population. Now, this language of condemnation has taken a more formal turn as Canada becomes the latest major US ally to move towards recognising Palestinian statehood.
Yeah, so we now have Canada, the UK and France as the latest G7 countries to part with the US and signal support for a Palestinian state. Canada, like France and the UK, intends to announce their support for this officially at the UN's General Assembly in September. This is all obviously very well coordinated between the various countries. The Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney has said this is in response to the rapidly deteriorating situation in Gaza, and he said the prospects of a two-state solution have steadily and gravely eroded, citing the threat of Hamas to Israelis, the humanitarian crisis in Gaza, and settler violence against Palestinians. Now, the interesting thing is, while France and the UK are talking about this largely in relation to Gaza, Canada is saying that recognition of a Palestinian state is predicated on reforms by the Palestinian Authority, like a change in governance, elections in 2026 in which Hamas could play no part. France, of course, has had quite a significant shift from the start of the conflict when they said they had unconditional support for Israel, and they're also citing the similar horror at the situation in Gaza. They were the co-hosts of the UN conference in New York this week, pushing other states to recognise an independent Palestinian state.
And I'm interested as well, you mentioned the UK, of course, recognising a Palestinian state, and I do think it's worth pointing out how their recognition of a Palestinian state is conditional. So there's an ultimatum attached to it saying they will support it in September at this same UN meeting, but at this stage only if Israel doesn't agree to a ceasefire. Why do you think they gave this ultimatum?
Look, I think it's basically because Keir Starmer has said in the past that this is a lever you get to pull once. It shouldn't be done for a symbolic reason. It should have a practical basis towards peace. And so that's what they're trying to do. Now, the Israeli government has responded quite negatively, as you would expect, saying, look, this only helps Hamas. It doesn't help get the hostages out. Why are there demands on Israel and not Hamas as part of this recognition of a Palestinian state? But Keir Starmer says this is the moment to act. it's partly about domestic politics as well. There's a lot of people in his own party have been pushing for this, saying that the UK has been too far behind the rest of the world in acknowledging what's going on in Gaza. The timing was interesting too. He announced it the day after the US president met with him. Initially, Donald Trump didn't seem particularly fussed about it, saying, look, he's got other things to focus on. He was busy playing golf. It's up to the UK. It's up to France. But then eventually he sort of followed that Israeli line a little bit, saying that recognition was simply rewarding Hamas.
And this has really put the pressure on Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, who has been fielding questions since about whether this will push Australia towards immediate recognition of Palestinian statehood. Here's a bit of what he had to say at a presser the other day.
What we will continue to do is to put forward a principal position consistent with our unwavering commitment to the vision of the two-state solution. In immediate sense, we continue to call for a ceasefire. We continue to call for hostages to be released. We continue to say that Hamas can have no role in a future Palestinian state.
So Albanese says Australia supports a pathway towards recognition, but certain conditions must be met. He signed a fresh joint statement alongside 14 other countries, and it really centred around conditions laid out by the Palestinian Authority, including, as he just mentioned, Hamas disarmament, also elections next year to be held and the release of all remaining hostages. But the PM has also most recently met with UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer. And, you know, even though he said in a press conference yesterday that timing isn't everything, do you think this will put the pressure on Anthony Albanese?
Yeah, look, firstly, Keir Starmer is not really the sort of leader who's going to pressure other leaders into sort of following his lead. But but Starmer and Albanese do have quite a lot in common. Albanese has said the meeting reaffirmed Australia's commitment to a two-state solution for Israel and the Palestinians. And we heard Jim Chalmers, the Treasurer, saying that the treatment of hostages and any involvement of Hamas in a future Palestinian state remain the major obstacles for Australia, but added that the government will push for a two-state solution. And he told the ABC it's a matter of when, not if, Australia recognises a Palestinian state.
This all comes as the United States Special Envoy to the Middle East, Steve Witkoff, reportedly left for talks to Israel on Wednesday. It's not yet clear who will be involved in those discussions, but a senior US official's statement said it was to address the humanitarian situation in Gaza. We know Trump recently disputed Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu's denial that starvation was occurring in Gaza, acknowledging the starvation we've been seeing in the Strip. Many Democrats and Republicans have been calling on the Trump administration to do more to ensure the flow of aid into Gaza. Obviously, Israel and the US were not in attendance at this UN conference on Monday through to Wednesday, and they're two parties really key to any ceasefire negotiation, but they did boycott the event, and it really raises questions around efforts towards a ceasefire.
Absolutely. And there is real concern now about these ceasefire negotiations, especially after Israel and the US essentially pulled out last week. And there are questions now as to what this means for a ceasefire deal. Is it at all possible if the parties aren't in the same place and talking? All of this as we get continued reports of starving civilians. Now, interestingly, the European Union is considering partially suspending Israeli funding under one of its flagship research programs. That would be the bloc's first action against Israel. There really is pressure on this visit from Steve Witkoff as well. It's unlikely to lead to any breakthroughs in the ceasefire talks, as we understand it, but it could increase the pressure on the Israeli government to do more to get more aid into Gaza. We don't know if Witkoff is going to be visiting Cairo and Doha as well, the sort of stops you would expect if these negotiations are to resume.
It's going to be great. I look forward to playing it today. We'll play it very quickly, and then I go back to D.C. and we put out fires all over the world. We did one yesterday. As you know, we stopped a war, but we stopped about five wars. So that's much more important than playing golf. As much as I like it, it's much more important.
A golf trip with a side of diplomacy is how US President Donald Trump's latest trip to Scotland is being described. As Trump cut the ribbon at his new golf course in Aberdeen, he did manage to find time for talks with the UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer, secure a trade deal with the EU and put the pressure on Russia to end its assault on Ukraine, reducing a 50-day deadline for a ceasefire down to 10 or 12 days. Ben, you just got back from Scotland. What has the feeling been around Trump's golf meets diplomacy trip?
Yeah, Kat, let's just be blunt here. It was strange. You had the sitting US president flying across the Atlantic to do a tiny little bit of diplomacy, but mostly work on his short game.
What a gig.
It was bizarre. And yeah, that press conference with Keir Starmer went for 90 minutes. And on one second, he'd be talking about Gaza. And then he started boasting about the quality of the windows at his golf resort and then talking about Jeffrey Epstein. And Keir Starmer looked like he wanted a hole to open up in the ground beneath him to swallow him up so he could get away from what was going on.
Yeah.
The whole thing was strange. Donald Trump loves Scotland. Donald Trump loves golf. We know that. He also loves throwing his weight around a bit diplomatically, and that's what he was trying to do. Perhaps the most unexpected thing he said was talking about Russia's war on Ukraine. He said that line, he said a few times now about, you know, you talk to Putin, you have a nice conversation, and the next day a nursing home gets bombed. He's clearly frustrated by this. And so he said that the 50-day deadline he'd put in place for Russia to agree to a ceasefire would be reduced to 10 days, and the clock is ticking now. The Kremlin's response, well, the next night they fired a bunch of glide bombs into a Ukrainian prison, killing 17 people. So obviously it's not having a huge impact on Moscow's thinking at the moment, but it seems the president is serious about this. I woke up this morning to news that he said we're going to put secondary sanctions on India because they buy so much Russian oil. And those secondary sanctions that he's threatening also against China could have a big impact on Moscow's thinking, because if countries stop buying Russian oil, Russia has less money to play with, it's harder to fund the war.
Yeah, and amid all the golfing, President Trump did secure a meeting with European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen and locked in a new trade deal with the EU. The US will now impose a 15% tariff, so half of the original 30% tariff threatened, and the EU agreed to spend hundreds of billions of dollars on weapons and energy products. Most commentary is suggesting Trump is the big winner out of this deal. What do you make of it?
Yeah, on the surface, yes. It looks like the US has done well, you know, 15% tariffs when previously there were barely any. Mm. There's a bit of dispute within the EU as to whether Ursula von der Leyen has done the right thing here. After the deal, she spoke to the press and she said straight up, 15% is the best we could have hoped for. We've heard President Macron now essentially saying, look, I think we probably could have played a little bit of a, you know, harder ball here, where the world's largest combined trading market, maybe we've rolled over a little bit too easily for the US. Talking about those European commitments too, to spend billions on weapons and energy products, there's not a huge amount of detail around this. And there is a chance that Europe simply doesn't need the amount of energy that von der Leyen has committed to purchase. So I think there's been a little bit of bluffing, a bit of massaging the figures here to make this sound more impressive than it is. And of course, there's the fact that this is just an agreement between two leaders. The European Union is a big organisation. This is all going to have to go through a vote in the European Parliament, so it could still all fall apart. However, Donald Trump says it's a big win, and that's how it's being reported in America.
Yeah, and Trump and Starmer met in the ballroom of the US president's Turnberry Golf Club, and perhaps this turf was deliberate. As you mentioned earlier, Trump was said to dominate the entire conversation, which went on for just over an hour. It seems the leaders were also quite complimentary of each other, despite coming from opposite ends of the political spectrum. But there were some sticking points for Trump that emerged from their chat, namely around immigration and energy resources.
Yeah, they're a funny pair, these two, aren't they? They couldn't be more apart politically, on background, on style, like just polar opposites. But for some reason, they seem to get on pretty well. And I think that's partly because Starmer just butters Trump up with compliments and sort of papers over the differences, focuses on the things they have in common. Interesting move from Starmer to bringing his wife, Victoria. Of course, Melania Trump wasn't on the trip, but Donald Trump seemed to be quite delighted by that. What Victoria Starmer, an eminently qualified lawyer herself, would have made of this whole situation, God knows. their conversation was fascinating as to what they agree on, what they don't agree on. And it was really interesting too, because there was a lot of right-wing press travelling with the president, including GB News, which is kind of like Britain's version of Fox News.
Mm.
And the reporter from GB News kept trying to get Donald Trump to criticise the UK's immigration policies, the stop the boats sort of business. And this reporter kept asking questions about it and said, you know, don't you think it's terrible that the UK has uncontrolled mass illegal immigration? And every time she asked, Donald Trump somehow turned his answer into a rant about wind turbines every time. She goes, isn't the immigration terrible? And they go, yes, it's terrible. But you know what else is terrible? Windmills, as he calls them, off the coast. He hates wind turbines. I think Starmer would probably have been quite pleased with the fact that more time was spent talking about wind turbines than illegal immigration. But it is one of the strangest press conferences I can remember. And that's saying something, given that it involved Donald Trump.
Nothing to do, of course, with the fact that they happen to be dotting his golf course, I'd imagine.
No, not at all.
And of course, it won't be long before President Trump is back in the UK for a state visit hosted by King Charles, becoming the first world leader in modern times to undertake two state visits to Britain. Southeast Asia seemed to be on the brink of war this week, with Thailand and Cambodia trading their worst cross-border fire in more than a decade. After months of tension along the border, it started last Thursday with each side accusing the other of firing the first shots. It ended with 38 people dead, mostly civilians, and more than 300,000 displaced.
On Monday night, the leaders of both countries travelled to Malaysia, where Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim brokered an unconditional ceasefire. For the most part, it seems to be holding, but with both Bangkok and Phnom Penh already accusing each other of multiple violations, it's looking like a very shaky deal. As luck would have it, our correspondent Claudia Farhad is beginning her new posting in Thailand this week and is joining us on the pod from Bangkok now. Hello, Claudia.
Hello, Ben. Hello, Kat. Yes, quite a week to arrive in Thailand, to say the least.
Yeah, let's start off with a big story, hey? And this ceasefire deal, what is the feeling around it? Is it expected to last, or could we see a return to the fighting?
I think the problem is, if you look at all the core reasons that this fighting erupted last week, none of them have actually been resolved by this ceasefire deal. As you mentioned, Kat, this has been simmering away for months before last week's fighting began. Back in May, a Cambodian soldier was killed in a pretty contained gunfight across the border. Then we saw weeks of tit-for-tat retaliations. You might remember Cambodia banned Thai fruit and vegetable. Thailand cut off its internet services with Cambodia. But none of that is really why we arrived here. The real reasons date back more than 100 years when French colonialists drew a border between the two nations, and a border that many people here in the region was pretty shoddily drawn. And along that border are two very ancient temples that both sides claim ownership of. In the case of one of them, the ICJ has since twice ruled that it falls within Cambodia's sovereignty, but Thailand has always rejected that. So yes, we do have a ceasefire deal, but that doesn't solve any of those issues, the issues of this contested border, these contested temples. And these temples have been flashpoints for a long time. Fighting has flared again and again over them, and that's probably going to continue for as long as the dispute does. And here's the other thing. Yes, Malaysia did broker this peace deal in its capacity as ASEAN chair, but both sides were under enormous pressure from the US to end the fighting as well. And that's because August 1 is the US's tariff deadline, the day those higher rates will come into effect if Thailand and Cambodia haven't done a deal with the White House. And both of them have been threatened with 36% tariffs if they don't get there. They're some of the highest rates globally. And Trump told them that negotiations around those tariffs weren't going to continue without a ceasefire, that both countries count the US as their largest trading partner. So there was plenty of incentive to get the deal done. But the speculation here in Thailand quickly became, if they didn't get a last-minute deal, and it looks like they will, the fighting could soon resume. Authorities here in Thailand have told about 150,000 people in evacuation to stay put, so that might say it all.
And behind all of this, we also have a pretty spectacular relationship breakdown between two of the region's most powerful families, the Shinawats in Thailand and the Huns in Cambodia. How much of this is about their feud?
Yeah, even with all of those issues we talked about, the two countries had a pretty good relationship until just recently, and that was largely due to the friendship between these two former leaders, Thaksin Shinawat and Hun Sen, both who remain extremely powerful in their own countries because their children were ruling. To give you an idea of how close they were, when Thaksin was ousted in a coup back in 2006, he and his family went to live with Hun Sen in Cambodia. They were so close, they said they were like brothers. Well, not anymore, it would appear. That all changed in June when Hun Sen dropped quite a bomb on Facebook by leaking the audio of a phone call with Thaksin's daughter Paetong Tan, in which she called him uncle and took aim at Thai military commanders. And there's two things you can't really do here in Thailand. One is insult the monarchy and the other is insult the military. So Hun kind of went nuclear with that leak. Paetong Tan has since been stood down as prime minister and we have yet another political crisis here in Thailand. And why Hun did that has kind of bewildered people here. Analysts are speculating he might have been trying to stir up some political turmoil to make his son, Hun Manet, who's the current prime minister, look a bit more legitimate. He's often dismissed as just being his father's puppet, I suppose. So how much of this is about the feud? Well, at times during the past week of fighting, it's kind of been hard to tell whether it's about the border dispute, about the temples, or about the personal dispute. Both former leaders went online on day one of the fighting to throw insults at each other. Thaksin said the Thai army was going to teach Hun Sen a lesson. The thing is that even when these two dynasties were enjoying their close friendship, these flare-ups along the border couldn't be avoided. So you kind of have to wonder now what's going to happen now that they've all but declared each other enemies.
Thanks for talking us through all the family drama from Thailand, Claudia.
Thanks, guys.
Plenty of other big events happening across the world also worth mentioning. We initially were planning to cover the earthquake off Russia's east coast, one of the most powerful in recorded history. But thankfully, the tsunami alerts triggered across the Pacific have all been scaled back. So let's look into another environmental shift of a different kind causing its own tremors. The Trump administration is planning to effectively erode any legal foundation for all US greenhouse gas regulations. So the Environment Protection Authority said on Tuesday that they planned to repeal the, quote, endangerment finding, which was established in 2009, and this determined that carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases endanger public health and welfare.
Yeah, the move would remove limitations on greenhouse gas pollution from vehicles, power plants and other sources, but does confront some legal obstacles first and would need to undergo a public comment period. Now, of course, environmental groups and advocates are blasting the move, which they say signals an end to any effort by the US to combat climate change. And of course, this is in addition to withdrawing once again from the Paris Climate Change Accord.
And Syria has announced it will hold its first parliamentary elections since the fall of former President Bashar al-Assad, with voting scheduled to take place between the 15th and 20th of September. The vote will be held under the authority of interim President Ahmad al-Sharaa, who took power following a rapid rebel advance that ousted al-Assad at the end of last year.
A third of the 210 seats in the new assembly will be appointed directly by al-Sharaa, while the remaining two-thirds will be filled through provincial-level elections and electoral colleges in each province. The announcement comes amid heightened political uncertainty and deepening divisions over Syria's new leadership, particularly after a wave of violence between the Bedouin and Druze communities erupted in Sweida earlier this month.
And finally, to Africa. It's been a while since we've reported on IS attacks, but this week the militant group has been linked to a massacre at a church in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. More than 40 worshippers were killed in the town of Komanda in an attack claimed by the Allied Democratic Force.
The ADF was formed in the 1990s and initially concerned with domestic grievances within Uganda. But after re-emerging in the DRC, its activity has taken on a more global jihadist dimension, with attacks increasingly being claimed in the name of the Islamic State group. According to research by BBC Monitoring, nearly 90% of IS operations are now carried out by affiliates in Africa.
Okay, we've covered some pretty heavy news on the pod today. So Ben and I wanted to lighten the mood for you a little bit with some in case you missed it news. And what's better than a bit of young love, or is it unkind to say maybe middle-aged love? Both of these notable figures have fallen out of favour with the public in recent months. One quite literally for her controversial trip to space and back, and the other resigned from a decade in office after declining popularity and growing discontent. Now they're sparking romance rumours in political and pop music circles.
Yes, it's the Venn diagram you never thought you needed. If you haven't guessed by now, we're talking about California girl Katy Perry and former Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Now, I have it from a very reputable source, TMZ, that the pair were caught having dinner together in Montreal. Fireworks were flying, allegedly. Oh. I get it. It's a song pun there.
You had to do that. Well, I did some research of my own, a very reputable source as well, BuzzFeed, and it turns out it runs in the family. Justin Trudeau's father and former Canadian PM, Pierre Trudeau, dated the one and only Barbara Streisand in 1969. So before we exhaust any more Katy Perry song titles and lose all credibility as serious journalists, let's leave on a high note, Ben.
Coming up next week, we'll be covering all the fallout from Trump's tariffs deadline and the countries who did and didn't make a deal, plus the latest on ceasefire talks between Israel and Hamas and Ukraine and Russia.
And that's The World This Week. Don't forget to like and subscribe if you're enjoying the pod. Thanks for joining us today, Ben. See you next time.
Catch you then, Kat.